You're listening to TCRG to CEO Radio with your host, Courtney J., TCRG.
All right. We are all very lucky today to have a guest, Niall O'Leary from New York. And Niall is in a really unique position because he's not only a teacher, but he's also an adjudicator and a musician. So welcome, Niall, to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Delighted to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, Niall, we're, again, really lucky because Niall is a man of many talents, many projects, always on the go, always has things going on. And it might be easier to ask him what he doesn't do, but Niall, tell us about you, how you started dancing and what you're up to these days.
So I started dancing when I was four, and I was fortunate to be trained by a man called Kevin Massey, who was famous within Irish dancing circles during his lifetime, but wasn't at all well known outside of that. But it turns out he's the guy who trained Michael Flatley when he went to Ireland. And then Michael Flatley decided that he would move to Ireland for a year to study with Kevin Massey. And then he won the World Championships that year. And so Kevin Massey was very passionate and a really highly skilled dancer and teacher. And he was off his time in the fact that he threatened us all in class, and that's how we got good. But he was very insistent on doing things a certain way. And I was very inspired by his passion and by his teaching and by his dancing. And so I started off dancing at four. I started playing the accordion when I was seven. And I was learning just piano, accordion, general music. And then I got really into traditional music, and I was fascinated by the intersection between the two. And I would sit for hours at an Irish dancing fest in Dublin, waiting my turn to dance, which was the way it was. There was no schedule.
Or, yeah.
And just showed up, and I would sit there listening to the music. And then when it was my turn to dance, if I particularly danced well, I would make a note of the tune that was played. And if I won, I would remember to that day nearly what the tune was.
Wow.
And I was interested in the music and specifically how it related to the dancing. And then when it was time to decide what I wanted to do, like all my friends in school were doing law and doctors and things, and I was thinking, hey, I'd like to be an architect. And I'd been fascinated by the design process of buildings since we had an extension to our house put on when I was, I guess I was still a single digit. And we had a number of meetings with the architect, which I sat in on, and I was fascinated by the whole thing. And then to see something getting built, and I was like, that's something that I would be interested in. And then, of course, I became fascinated with the intersection between dance and architecture. And as I flippantly have remarked to people, they're both about space and structure. And so when I was in architecture school in Dublin, I got 2 degrees in University College Dublin, and I never itemized my time between the dancing and the architecture, because in my head, they were all the one thing.
That's really interesting. So I really thought I wanted to be an architect when I was like a young girl. Yeah. Obviously I did not end up pursuing that path, but I have never thought of the crossover before, but I totally get what you're saying.
It's all about interpreting space. And I suppose you'd say the goal of the built environment is to kind of capture space. And so like, there's a lot of similarity. And I remember being inspired by one of my tutors in college had spent a year at an architecture school, unfortunately titled AA. It's the Architectural Association, a famous architecture school in London. And he told me the story about a girl in her final year who danced her thesis.
Wow.
And she did like a modern dance or something. And I was thinking, I think that's really cool. But then I chickened out, but I didn't do it. I designed a building instead.
So do you still do architecture?
Yes, I have my own practice. I worked slaving away like most people do in New York City, many unpaid hours of overtime for 5.5, 6 years. And then I started my own practice after that. And at the time I was thinking, I have enough projects to keep going for maybe a summer, maybe a year, and then I'll go back and work in corporate America. And I actually never went back to work in corporate America. I got busy with the architecture. And then in more recent years, I've got busier, you'd say, with the dancing and the music. And so I'm still working as an architect, but not full-time. But I'm very interested in taking on projects where there's an element of design involved. And I'm always talking to people about my passion for design and how I believe that people can function better, whether it's living or working, in a well-designed space.
Yes.
And so I think everyone can benefit from that. And I have so many really great friends who've opened dance studios, and they didn't hire an architect clearly because they hired an architect who maybe just filed the project but didn't really design it. And I'm thinking, oh, that could have been nicer, you know. But and I've seen like waiting rooms and dance studios where it looks like the back of a bus, and I'm thinking that's not what it could be.
I might need you to help me, Niall.
I actually could.
Now, is that what brought you to New York City, or did something else bring you here?
So I came to New York City for the summer, and my idea was that I would come over for the summer, check it out. I'd been to New York City twice before on a couple of tours from Ireland with a band. And so I was thinking, yeah, I'll come over for the summer and see how it goes. And I came over with the intention of working as an architect, which I had extreme trouble with in the first few weeks looking for work. And then I just one thing led to another. And I got three interviews in the space of 1 week. And then one of them offered me a job at the end of the fourth week, where at which point I ran out of money. And then I suddenly found myself with an architecture job. And there was an apartment I'd seen in Greenwich Village where they had a room to rent for the summer. And I really liked it, but I had said to the person renting the room, I can't afford it. And then suddenly I had a job. I was like, now we can afford it, maybe. And yeah. I called up and the room was still available. And so I moved in that summer, moved out the following September, moved back in the following summer, and I'm sitting here right now. I've been here ever since.
Wow, that's quite a story.
Amazing. And I'm rent stabilized, which if you know anything about New York City living situations, rent controlled is mostly elderly people who've been living in the same building their entire life and they're paying a fraction of the market rate. And then rent stabilized is something that most people kind of fall into. And in my case, I got my name on the lease and it rolled over onto my name then when my next roommate left. And so rent stabilized is usually, used to be half the market rate, now it's about a third the market rate. So in that sense, I'm winning.
Yeah, super, super lucky. That was really great. Now, when you came to New York, where were you at with your dancing at that point in time? Were you still competing? Were you already a TC?
I was already a TCRG, yes. And so I had won the All-Ireland Championships at the age of 10. And there was a video went up on the RTÉ archives this year. And I literally hadn't, I was lucky enough that the year I won, it wasn't there an RTÉ, an Irish national television crew at the event. And they recorded me dancing outside the Mansion House in Dublin. And it was very exciting. I knew I was going to be on the news. And I was on the 9 o'clock news, the main news show that evening. And then I hadn't seen the video again. We went home and watched it that night. I hadn't seen the video again until this year. It showed up on the RTÉ archives.
Wow. If you have the link to that, you'll have to share it, because when I put all your ways people can keep up with you in the show notes, I would love to include that.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of people commented, he's got the same hair. It's like, did you not see my feet? I've got the same feet as well. But anyway, and so then I won the World Championships when I was 21. And then I competed. I guess I did a lot of shows then after that. I did a number of different like cabaret shows and then some more cultural shows. And then the plan was I was taking a summer away from that to come over to New York. But then I had such a great time here that summer that I decided to stay. And so I already had committed to a festival in Blackpool in England on October that year. And so I went back to do this festival. Then when I was back in Blackpool, I had a quick trip to Dublin where I met a friend of mine who said, we really want you in this pantomime that we're doing at the Point Theatre, which is where Riverdance had started. I was like, yeah, I want to be in it. So I agreed to do that. And that was 24 shows in 10 days.
That's a lot.
And, and Barney the Dinosaur was actually the star of the pantomime. And so I remember my architecture boss at the time calling up my house in Dublin. He said, I thought you said you were coming back on January the 4th. And I said, no, I said January the 24th. And so I literally got an extra few weeks to do this show. But I was lucky enough that my architecture boss like knew I was passionate about the dancing. And basically what he said to me was, as long as it doesn't interfere with your architecture work. So,
and did it often?
Not really.
No, okay, that's good.
Potentially no, not at all.
So how long after you moved to New York did you start teaching or open your own school?
So when I started teaching, really, it was, I guess my first student was Dara Carr, who is a dancer from Ohio originally, who had trained with Tim O'Hare. And then she did her thesis in dance at Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Yep.
And her thesis was called Traditional Dance, or no, it was Irish Dance, Pushing the Boundaries of a Traditional Form. And so we met up one evening. She gave me a copy of her thesis. I'd met Dara in Dublin. And then we met up one evening and we started doing some dancing together. We were having dinner. She gave me a copy of her thesis. And we met up for dinner to discuss it. And I told her all the things that I didn't agree with in her thesis. And we became best friends.
Awesome. I love that.
So then I said to her, you know, you should, I said, you should go back and dance in the Whirls. And she was like, you know, maybe I will. And so the Whirls were in Galway the following year. And she was like, yeah, let's do it. And she brought her dad and everything. And he'd come with her to the Whirls for years. So it was a big nostalgic trip. And so she was my first official student. But around the same time, I was teaching a friend who is still a great friend today, who I met in New York. Her mother's friend's daughter was dancing away, but having a bit of trouble and not learning as well, you'd say. And I was asked to teach a kind of private classes on the side without anyone knowing. And so I agreed to do that. And I would take a subway train out to Queens. And the parents were Irish, and I'd get a nice feed of Irish dinner. And I'd teach the girl a class every Saturday for a number of months. And then after the Oireachtas, they said to me, you know, she enjoys your teaching. We'd actually like to join your school. And I said to the mother, that sounds great, but I really don't have a school. I've only one student. And the mother said to me, well, why don't we start one? And so the mother rounded up the local children and I started a class in her house. And around the same time, I started teaching adults in Manhattan. And it was just like, I was playing music in a bar, frankly, and I was playing the accordion and with the singer guitarist and stuff. And they had a room downstairs. I was like, oh, we could do a bit of dancing downstairs. And so we started an adult class. And so it kind of happened, you'd say, organically. And sometimes like you plan for something and it doesn't happen, but sometimes things happen organically.
Yeah, and sometimes the best things happen organically.
Exactly, yeah. So my first adult class, there was one guy in it who insisted on talking Irish. And when he did something wrong, he'd say, oh, vi fish, vi she, shin gahu fosig, which is mean, that was terrible. And I was like, dude, stop talking Irish. People are getting upset because nobody understands what you're saying except for myself. And he was trying to impress me. And then there was another guy who, I remember after a few weeks, I came in and he was dancing the light jig. And I was like, dude, you stole my style. And like everyone I told the story, they're like, I think that's what's supposed to happen. So it was great. But I taught adults and children in Ireland a little bit, but not really too seriously. But my first, you'd say, big teaching expose was that when the World Championships were in UCD, I actually had a figure dance team in the senior figures. And it was Niall O'Leary / UCD Dance Society. And it was the first and possibly only ever multinational team in the World Irish Dancing Championships. And I was actually on the organizing committee of the Worlds that year. And I was telling the guy, we were having a meeting, sitting in a circle upstairs at the uncommissioned offices in Harcourt Street at the time. And I was the youngest person in the room. I was just a new teacher, but I'd offered to help and they needed all the help they could get. Yeah. But we're sitting in the room in a circle. Everyone's just telling stories. Nothing's getting done. And I started telling the guy beside me what I was doing with this figure team. And he said to the whole room, we need to listen to Niall's story. He's onto something here. And I told him the story. And the first ever dancer from the continent of Africa, Puna Sidima Gasanelwe, was in the team. And she's from Botswana. She's now a doctor working for the Botswana government and represents the World Health Organization at different like pandemic world conferences. And then there was also dancers from Germany, Finland, Switzerland, Australia, Belgium, United States, and Ireland.
That's incredible. I mean, that's everything we hope a world championships to be.
And if there was any social media at the time, you'd say, I would have been famous. But we put up posters around the campus and we did our own like kind of, you say, campaigning. And we also had four sponsors and we had a local supermarket, a local Volkswagen garage. We had Heineken and Dunkin' Donuts. So we had a Heineken and Dunkin' Donuts party that night. And so, yeah, it was a great time.
That's amazing. Wow.
So I was always on for like doing something, you'd say, exciting and memorable, you know? And so I guess New York City is a good place to do that too.
Yeah. Well, and being, you know, New York City, right? Like one of the greatest cities in the world, also notoriously one of the most expensive places to live, I would imagine that there are some unique opportunities in that, you know, there's so many theaters and there's Broadway and there's all of these creative people in New York City, but then there's also the challenges of it being an expensive place. How does that work for you as a business owner?
Yeah, so you'd say, yes, there's the excitement. You'd say the excitement of the opportunity to perform at some memorable spaces and big events.
I've seen you at Carnegie Hall. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So these kind of things, you'd say, make it all worthwhile. And all the restraints and hardships that one has to put up with to do that, like when you get to do big things, you'd say it's all worth it. But I have to say, in terms of running a dancing school, it's very different, I would say, to most other dancing schools, certainly in the United States or maybe in the world, in that most of our customers don't even own a car, never mind an SUV.
Right.
And most of them don't live in houses. Most of them don't have any room to practice at home. And so we're dealing with a different dynamic than most places. And in terms of looking for dance space, like, it's not really possible to just buy your own building in the center of Manhattan. Like, nope. So we're looking at the moment about doing some big campaign to actually, you know, have a cultural building that has dance space in the way we want it, which doesn't exist at the moment in terms of a building specifically for Irish dance. And so there is a huge opportunity, I feel, to do something. So we're looking into that at the moment. But the biggest problem we have is to find column-free space, to find space that's just big enough in terms of dimension, and to find a space where we can make noise and no one gets upset,
yep,
and to find the right kind of flooring. And so there, those are four challenges that are really, you'd say, that eliminates most spaces in the city, frankly.
Yeah.
And most places are built with a small column span. And for a number of years, we had classes in a building in Queens where there were two columns in the middle of the floor. And I said to people, it's like there's two extra dancers you have to dance around. But that's not ideal. And so we're looking now, we found a dance studio in Midtown where they do have all of the above. But our previous spaces, basically, some of them like asked us to leave and because we were just making too much noise, or like it was just, you know, that they didn't have the space available on a regular basis. But it's huge. It's a huge challenge, I think, really. And we have to make it work, obviously. And we're lucky that we have found a way to make it work, because there's a lot of people, you'd say, have tried to open dancing schools and just it gets complicated. And obviously, if you have like inherited money, or if you're taking over an existing dancing school, which clearly a lot of people do, then it's a bit easier, you'd say. But in my case, we kind of started off in bars and stuff, and we still have some like beginner classes in bars, but now most of our classes are in, you'd say, purpose-built dance studios. And we're lucky that they basically allow us to make a lot of noise.
Yeah, the noise on the columns, I know, is a problem that a lot of people face, but I'm sure it is just next level with how crowded and, you know, how buildings are built in New York City.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And we've had people who've said, oh, we can have you dance in our building, but we're going to have to put you in the basement, or we're going to have to put you on a certain floor or something. And there was one dance studio where it was an old building. It got demolished since. It was an old building that had like metal ties in the wall to kind of keep the wall from falling over. And we were doing a 3-hour dance drama rehearsal with a lot of hard shoe dancing in it. And as I came down the stairs after the dance drama rehearsal, they basically said to me, thank you for coming today, but please don't ever come back. You shook the building and we're afraid you've actually structurally damaged it. And then the gas thing was then they let us come back to do soft shoe dancing only.
But okay. No,
yeah.
I mean, that's, I guess, a partial solution.
Yeah. So we offer demolition services as well. If anyone needs a crew to come and demolish a building, we can do that too.
And do you find you have a very transient population of dancers in New York City with people moving in and out, or is your, are your families or your dancers pretty stable in New York?
So that's an interesting question, because we actually have class locations in other places where we do have a very transient population. And in particular now, I have currently classes in Mississippi, and I used to have classes along the coast in Florida. And in both cases, they're near either army or military bases. And so these are people who move every 3 or 4 years. And so we've had a lot of people coming and going. But I must say, I specifically say to them, where are you moving to? And then I connect them with a dancing teacher in the area. So we don't just say to them, here's a few numbers to call. We actually connect them. And also I have had classes for many years in Cancun in Mexico, where again, people are very transient. Most people, most Mexicans who live in Cancun are not from Cancun. They're from Mexico City or elsewhere. And then they often go back to Mexico City or they go somewhere else. And so dealing with transitional communities is a huge challenge. But in New York City, I would say there's so many people you'd say to choose from in terms of Irish dancing that we're lucky. We always have enough people in the class so that it's not like if people suddenly have to leave or something, then we always have enough people still in the class. And so we've had a few people come and go over the years, but most people stay with us, I would say 4 or 5 years at least. And obviously a lot of adults, you know, they move to Manhattan in their 20s and then maybe they start getting married and having children. And then their situation changes. They move to a house in New Jersey with a white picket fence. And then they like my social media posts, but I may never see them again.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
But and I'm glad you mentioned your school in Mexico, because I definitely wanted to ask about that. Like, how did that develop and how do you manage to run multiple locations, but locations that are in different countries, different states?
Yeah, so I think the key thing in having, like, I suppose what could be termed as a satellite location, I'm not sure what the official terminology is for this at the moment, they keep changing it. There was a while you couldn't say the word workshop, and now you're allowed to say the word workshop again. But I would say the key thing is having good people running the location who live there on my behalf. And so I must say, all the locations that I've taught in over the years, we've had good people running them. And we've people who are not just, you'd say, good people where they treat people well, they know how to like deal with people, but they're also good dancers and good teachers. And some of them mightn't be the best dancers in the world, but they know how to like teach. And then basically I do the choreography and I do regular classes. Now I'm fortunate enough, I can do weekly classes on Zoom. And we've class in Mississippi this evening on Zoom. And yeah. So like basically I'm regular all the time. And so I'm there choreographing, correcting, inspiring and working on technique. And so like the fact that like Zoom now exists, I was using Skype and different things before, but they weren't as good as Zoom. And so it's definitely more possible, you'd say, to run a successful out of town location than it was in the past, you know, but obviously I show up quite a bit as well. And that's important too. But I think like, as I say, like if someone wants to open a class somewhere far away, if you don't really have someone good running it, then someone that you can know and trust and who you know can do as well, then it's very challenging. And I have to say, one of the greatest experiences I've had was coming into a class and meeting somebody who maybe just started. There was one particular case of an adult who had started a few months before and I hadn't met them. And I show up and they're dancing the light jig just like me. And this is somebody who was taught by the person who I taught, and they taught them to dance like me. And I'm thinking,
that's like the biggest compliment, I think.
Yeah. So like we said earlier about if a student is stealing my style is one thing, but if somebody who I taught is then teaching it, then
yeah.
That's even better.
Yeah. Yeah, that shows they're doing an incredible job. Now, did you pick these locations because you had that person to run it in mind, or did the location come first and then you found that person that you trust and can run the location for you?
Oh, in most cases, it was people who reached out to me and asked me either, can I come to like, is there any summer camp or any workshop or any masterclass you're doing? Or who said to me, would you like to come and do a workshop in our studio? And so that's what it was mostly. And in most cases then they were like, oh, can we come back to the masterclass? Or can you come and visit us? Or would you like to come here more regularly? And so people who you'd say enjoyed my teaching and enjoyed my choreography. And like, I remember one workshop I did, which it was ended up just being a workshop. They didn't become part of my school. But the teacher said, that was really great. And you didn't shout and scream at anyone. And I was like, oh, was I supposed to? And she's like, no, but the last person did. And so I feel like that and I use this phrase guardedly, but a lot of my esteemed professional colleagues use intimidation and bullying as a means of teaching. And before you'd say all the scandals about Irish dancing, you'd say surfaced in the last few years, I would say the big elephant in the room was emotional bullying. And it's very hard to quantify it. It's very hard to measure it. And I've talked to former dancers who've said, all the people I was in dancing class with none of us are friends with each other. We've all had to go for therapy because of the emotional bullying that we were subjected to as Irish dance students. And I would have to say, I don't do that. And I feel it's been very well received, the fact that I don't do that. And I've taught some people who have obviously suffered from it, from other people. And it's a huge problem, I think, and something that hasn't really been addressed, I feel, to this day. And anytime I mention anything like that needs to happen in Irish dancing in the last couple of years, there's one phrase that people use: Niall, there's bigger fish to fry.
I mean, that's all right. Now we've opened Pandora's box, because I mean, I think if nothing else, the last year, right? Has it been a full year? A little more than a year, I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's made everyone in Irish dancing kind of take a long, hard look at themselves and a long, hard look at how we present to the outside world, right? Like the normies that, you know, either saw us as just like, oh, you know, those people that come out at St. Patrick's Day, or like, oh, those people that wear the giant hair, right? Yes. And it's also, I think, you know, you spoke about your own teacher, you know, had kind of used that tactic of like, this is the right way to do it, and I'm going to scream at you, and that's what's going to make you good. And I think for a long time, maybe people that grew up with that teaching method, that's how they were taught. So that's how they went on to teach, and everyone kind of does what they were taught. Like they recreate that. And I, you know, you see it in family systems and everything too. Whereas yeah, I think
the workplace, in supermarkets.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So I think as everyone starts to know better and learn other ways to, you know, a lot of people are teaching kids, like they're babies, you know, you can't yell and scream at babies and kids because it does it completely. Yep. You know, anyone, we're all humans.
Yeah.
And I think we're slowly, I like to think we're slowly making a transition of treating people like humans and not as machines or as robots to kind of win things, because they're so much more important. Yeah. You know, things that people need to take away from this than, oh, I want a trophy at a fash.
Yeah. No, I hope you're right. And I feel now there's more attention being paid to mindfulness and compassion and understanding than there has been in the past. And I think the pandemic caused everyone to kind of stop what they were doing and kind of do a stock take almost.
Absolutely. And
I think that a lot of people have looked at how they were doing things and hopefully have figured out maybe a better way than emotionally bullying people into success.
Now, without naming names, have you seen anyone that you feel has maybe taught with that emotional bullying side successfully transition into not teaching that way?
Well, I honestly don't know. I've had, like, I obviously am going on eyewitness reports.
Yeah.
Of people I trust who have told me things. And so I actually would like to think, yes, that some people have transitioned into a way of being more aware of hurting people's feelings, basically. And so you'd like to think that things have changed, but I don't know if everyone has changed, but there's some people you wonder if they were successful doing it one way, like, do they feel that they need to change? And
right, I think that is a big question.
Yeah, like if your dancers are winning, like, and if it's about winning at all costs, then maybe you don't need to change. Maybe your ego takes over and you're like, well, this is the way I do it and I'm successful. But I have to say, there's a lot of people who I've heard reports of who, like, I found it shocking to think that they were like body shaming people and emotionally abusing people. And these are people who I would know, like, to say hello to, who are the nicest people. And on a professional level, like, I must say, like, generally speaking, most people are really friendly and very respectful of each other. But then it turns out some of these people, when you put them in a room of, I suppose, children mostly,
yeah,
then they treat people like animals. And, like, it's shocking to think that people got away with that over the years, because I guess there was no reporting, really. There was no one to turn to, and there was no one to tell. And if you were giving out about your teacher, like, you kind of wouldn't be believed. Like, society wasn't at a point where, like, you would question somebody in authority. And there was no way around it, you know? And so people got away with stuff. And this is, you'd say, about general life and also about Irish dancing. And so nowadays people are, there's more, you'd say, checks and balances in that, like, you know, there's helplines and there's report. There has been, you'd say, systems set up where somebody can report something if they're not happy with something. And you'd say that we've done a better job as a society of protecting people. But yeah, is the system fail-safe? I would say no.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question of, you know, how effective do we think those systems actually are put into practice? And have we done enough in Irish dancing to make people feel safe and that they can, you know, report things without being penalized for it?
Yeah, I would say the thing is that it's like the system is only good as its most recent success. And, you know, the systems that have been put in place have been tested for many times where it's been discovered that the system didn't work. And in Irish dancing particularly, you'd say the process of how you make a complaint or how you deal with some wrongdoing, like that process has been done over so many times because it wasn't working. And one of the big things which came up obviously in the last year was that people who know other people having to make a decision about those people. And it's like, that really is putting people in an unfair position. And,
yeah,
you know, if you really like somebody, you're going to let them off. If you really hate them, you're going to like really do them. And so like, that shouldn't be a thing, you know? And so there was no system like that in place. But like, yeah, the thing is like that you'd like to think that we're constantly evolving. And I think you have to keep relooking at these things to make them better. And we'll never be in a situation where the whole thing is perfect. We can say, right, we have the perfect system now. We can just leave it there. That's never going to happen.
No. And all these things take time, unfortunately.
What you said about like reporting things without repercussions, that's one, a huge issue in Irish dancing, in that people feel clearly that if you make a complaint about somebody, that if you're kind of the person who's stirring it up, then that your dancers will be penalized. And the concept that somebody who's adjudicating can sit down at a table and can put everything out of their head except the dancing in front of them, like that's what adjudicating should be. But clearly it is now apparent that there's more going on than that. And the idea that people can, like, you know, pay back their friends, good or bad, while they're adjudicating, that should never be part of it. And we clearly need some kind of continuing professional development for adjudicators so that they're constantly reminded of what their actual job is. It's not adjudicating the look, the wigs, the costumes, the tanning. It's about the dancing.
Yes. And so I support that 100%.
I feel that that message has been blurred by the fact that there are so many of my, and I use the phrase again, esteemed professional colleagues who, you'd say, their livelihood is embedded in the presentation of Irish dancing. And
yes,
I'm specifically talking about people who have a financial interest in the costumes, the wigs, the tanning, or any kind of, you'd say, hair paraphernalia that goes up on stage with the dancers. And I'm not just talking about people who own the companies or people who work for the companies. I'm also talking about teachers who have a business relationship with, let's say, a costume manufacturer. And like, it is clearly like in their interest to keep this relationship. And certainly if there's an adjudicator who is also a costume company owner, like, wouldn't it be in their interests to look after, to use the phrase, like the dancers of their, one of their best customers? Because if the dancers who are wearing the costumes that they designed and made do not do well, they may lose the contract. And like, this has come up, but it has never been like formally established that this is an official business relationship. And
right, or conflict of interest of some kind.
Clear conflict of interest.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is something that I know it has come up recently, but I don't know, has there been any resolution about it?
Yeah. I mean, and talking about like the fear of retaliation or whatever, it doesn't even have to be real. You know, people's perception is everything. So whether it's real or imagined, I think it does prevent progress from happening sometimes.
Definitely.
But, you know, you're talking about the job of an adjudicator and being an adjudicator yourself. When you come to the table as not just an adjudicator, but also someone who's been very steeped in the tradition of Irish dancing and Irish music, and you add in your, you know, just love of choreography and art.
Yeah.
What is the most important thing to you when you sit down at the table? I'm just curious.
So, yeah. So I enjoy good music. And I have to say that pretty much most of the time I'm enjoying listening to music. If the musician is playing the same, if I'm sitting at a stage where the musicians are playing the same 7 or 8 tunes all day, I may get a little bored of that. But that doesn't happen too often. Most musicians mix it up a little bit. And I enjoy the music. But when I'm adjudicating, I enjoy the first 8 bars of the music. And then I'm busy judging the dancing after that. But, and the same thing with the costumes, like, and the looks, like, some people, I have to say, look a little bit ridiculous, but I'm not there to judge the costumes or the look. And if I see somebody who looks really nicely presented, again, I have like a few seconds before the music starts, then I have 8 bars in which to admire their appearance, and then that's over.
Yeah.
And the question is, if somebody looks good, it's like, you look good today, but can you dance?
Well, that's the most important question of them all, right? That's what we're all here to find out.
When I'm there to adjudicate, I have a lot of friends in Irish dancing. I have a lot of like styles of dancing I like. I have a lot of moves I like. I have a lot of, like, say, favorite colors. I have favorite tunes. But none of this impacts my adjudicating, because I'm not there to judge any of that. I'm not there to judge the choreography. I love watching people move around the stage. I'm fascinated by how people interpret space and the idea of like spatial pattern. I'm fascinated by that. And so I will be aware of that when I'm judging, but I'm really judging the dancing as presented to me on the day. And yes, I do feel disappointed for a really good dancer who doesn't get it right on the day, but they will have known they didn't get it right. And when they don't get the top mark, they will know they don't deserve it. Other people mightn't have been watching as closely, and people who are only looking at the results will think, that's weird. This dancer always wins. What happened? Who was judging? Did they not like them? Whereas the reality is, like, whether it's a child, a young teenager, or an older teenager, an adult, nobody has the perfect day every time. Nobody dances their best all the time. And
I think it's unfair to expect people to get it perfect all the time.
Exactly. And so, like, when I see about people winning, like, you know, titles 8 years in a row or something, I'm thinking, wow, that is a major achievement, because like to be at your best on the day, like, that's amazing. But you'd have to say, now with what we now know, you're wondering, like, was there 1 year where they weren't at their best and people felt that, well, they've won it every year, so there's a bit of pressure that they win it again? I don't know. Like, but obviously one would have to be forgiven for thinking that now. But I don't think it's about winning it 7 or 8 years in a row. I think it's about winning it in the moment. And I was at a really interesting, you'd say, theatrical production at the Irish Arts Centre in New York City a couple of years ago, minus the COVID, about 5 years ago. And it was a one-woman play from Ireland where...
Oh, is it Mara Clarkin?
It was a woman who had won an Irish dancing competition.
I think it was Mara Clarkin did a one-woman show.
It wasn't Mara Clarkin. No, it was,
Okay.
Was not Mara Clarkin. I've gone to see her works as well. Wasn't that one. It was a different, was a woman from Ireland. And there was a great moment in it where she was training hard for this big championship and she won first place. And then she's there with the trophy getting photographs. And somebody said to her, well done today. Now you have to defend it next year. And she said to them, excuse me, I've just practiced hard for this. I've achieved my goal. I've won it. And now you're telling me, you're trying to take it away from me and tell me that, like, oh, now I have to defend it. Can I just enjoy my winning moment? And you'd say there's a lot of pressure on people to keep winning every year. I don't think that's the thing. I think, like, if you win 1 year, the fact you won the previous year doesn't really matter. It's about how you dance on the day. And a lot of competitions are really close. And so there are some age groups over the years where a different person wins every year. And to me, that's a truer reflection of society, in that it is quite probable, not just possible, quite probable that a different person will dance the best on the day. And that's really what it's about. It's not about your reputation, what dancing school, what choreography you're presenting. It's about how you dance on the day. And I, having adjudicated the World Irish Dancing Championships in 2018, there were some competitions where it was very difficult to pick a winner.
Yeah, and sure.
It was just like, who, and like, I'm judging one round of every competition, and it's like, who's really the best person? Who's got the best technique? The best, like you'd say, just enjoyment in their dancing, and like, has really got all their moves right. And that was my winner basically in all the competitions. And if it was somebody who made maybe one mistake, if they were so far ahead of everyone else, they could, you can still win by making one or two mistakes. But if you kind of fall over your own feet, and then you get up and then you do something amazing, it's like, it's not really your day today, you know?
Yeah.
And so you feel that somebody who presents their material like almost flawlessly, not necessarily completely flawlessly, but if somebody like doesn't fall over while they're dancing, they have a better chance of winning on that day, you'd say. And the person who fell over, you'd be like, I'm sure you'll get it right the next time and you'll win then, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I know, you know, adjudicators watching, especially three at a time, right, can't see every moment of every person's dance, right? Like, you can't split your eyes in three different directions. But yeah, I personally have a lot of respect for adjudicators that do take it for what they saw on that day.
Yeah. Like, the thing about judging three at a time is that if it was one at a time, two at a time, three at a time, 10 at a time, like, the ultimate goal of adjudicating is to pick the first place winner, and then everyone else falls into place after that. So if I'm watching, I was actually playing the music at a FESH in Florida years ago, where the FESH was like 2 hours behind, and they decided to do the traditional sets five at a time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I was playing the music, I was sitting at the back of the stage, and I decided I'm just going to watch the adjudicator to see what they do. And the adjudicator did a quick scan and watched the best person.
And I think that's what would happen, right? Like, I think if, God forbid, we ever did dance, you know, 5, 10 at a time,
yeah,
I do think that the cream would rise to the top and they would get their recognition. But I do think the dancers that would be hurt by that are those dancers that are really just trying to make it into the recall that day, or, yeah, you know, the dancer who's always recalled, but is really going after that world medal that day, that you just might not get as much, you know, airtime, so to speak.
Well, that's it. And the thing is that, like, you know, as an adjudicator, I'm very aware of giving everyone, like, you know, you'd say a valid amount of attention. And I remember some FESH one time where some woman came up to the stage man, and she said, the adjudicator didn't watch my son at all. Can he re-dance? And they were told, no, sorry, that's not an option. But, like, you know, there's some FESH where you can actually see the adjudicator's eyes. And if they don't watch someone at all, that's a little bit disrespectful. So you try to watch everyone a little bit. But obviously, if you're looking for the winner, which is what your job is, then you have to look at the winner more. But I've actually had two conversations with people in recent years. One as recently as last week, where they were dancing at the Worlds in a competition of over 100, 200 people, whatever. And they're on stage with the previous year's winners, and then they don't recall. And so that, you'd say, is really unfortunate. That's just a bad draw. And
yeah,
if you're dancing two at a time or three at a time, you could still be on stage with last year's winner. And then, like, you just have to be in your top form, and you hope that, like, they will recognize you, that they won't be distracted. Especially, you'd say, it's easy for an adjudicator to get distracted by somebody who they recognize, or somebody who, like, say, they like, oh, I know this person is from, like, you know, a so-called important dancing school, or this person has won before or something. And you'd say, it's easy to get distracted, but the goal of the adjudicator is to not get distracted. But against that, I have to say, there was 1 year in the Mid-Atlantic Oireachtas specifically, I think it was girls under 13 or under 14, and they were dancing three at a time in one of the rounds. And there was two girls on the stage who were, of the three, two were really good, and they ended up coming first and second in the competition. And you're thinking, that actually would validate the idea that adjudicators are doing their job, because, like, the fact is, it would be easy to discard two if one is, like, if you pick one who's the best, but the two best dancers were actually, in a competition with 113 dancers, the two best dancers were actually on stage at the same time. And what are the chances of that? But that's what happened. And so, like, you'd have to say most adjudicators, you would think, you'd like to think, are actually judging on the day. But there's been certain reasons for us to think otherwise recently. But I still believe in the goodness of people. And I'm, you know, hopeful that most of my professional colleagues are not engaged in, you know, unsolicited activity, which would bring the entire adjudication process, you'd say, into question.
And I think, you know, for some of these things, I'm sure some of the dancers and dance parents that listen to the show are like, oh, no, like, I don't want to hear that, you know, if I'm on stage with the winner, you know, I might not get what I'm hoping for. But I think it's also really important for people to hear the perspective of an adjudicator and the kind of tough decisions and all the things you're trying to balance sitting there at the table. And I know I find this just when I'm watching a competition, like, we're all Irish dance enthusiasts at heart too, like, that just genuinely like to sit there and watch dancing. And it can be so easy to be distracted by someone who just really catches your eye for some reason. And I can only imagine sitting at the table officially to judge, you know, trying to like break that or snap yourself out of that. Like, oh, but I have to go watch the other dancer.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Like, yeah, there's, as I said, you're trying to watch the winner as much as possible if you think someone is potentially the winner. And but you have to give everyone a fair go. And clearly, like, if there are two dancers or even three dancers, it's quite possible there could be like first, second and third all dancing together. And you have to obviously recognize that you're not just looking to pick the best winner of the dancers on the stage. You're looking at what your perceived idea is of what the winner would look like. And so I feel like one has to have a concept of what are you looking for exactly in terms of what attributes is the winning dancer going to have? And like, clearly in a world level competition, there would be loads of dancers that would satisfy the criteria, but the ones who go above and beyond that in terms of their technique, you know, how high they're getting off the floor and just their overall performance on the day, really, that's what decides it.
Yeah, no, I do. I really appreciate that perspective. To change gears a little bit, I know that you have a great adult program.
Yeah.
You teach a lot of adult dancers, and it's something that we've seen, I think, a lot of change in the competitive landscape. We're starting to see adult championship popping up more. It was the subject of a lengthy discussion at the last North American Championship of like where we're going with that in the future. Yeah. So I would love to hear kind of the core tenets of your adult program at your school, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I have been teaching adults for many, many years, and I've been promoting the idea of competitive Irish dance for adults for many, many years as well. And it's great now to see that there are a lot of people who are opening new, a lot of our colleagues are opening new classes for adults. And a lot of people are taking an interest in the adult level competitions, which for many years they were kind of ignored as a sideshow.
Yep.
And the typical situation with the FESH was that, like, a lot of FESH did not have any competitions for adults at all. And then if they did, the adult competitions, surprise, surprise, the schedule comes out a few days before and the adults are the last to dance. And there was one FESH, an outdoor FESH in New York one time, where like I had one adult and a baby ran out on the stage in the middle of it. And then I remember saying to one of my adult dancers afterwards, I says, it's kind of sad. I said, you all danced, we had a group of adults in this one particular FESH. I said, you all danced well, but the only people watching was a man and his dog. And one of my dancers was like, that's my boyfriend and our dog. And the thing is like that, that's where the adult dancing was. It was listed on the syllabus. It actually happened at the FESH, but nobody really cared for it. Nobody took it seriously. And it was kind of an afterthought. And that now has all changed. And it took quite a while for that to happen. But I'm delighted to see that the adults are now taken more seriously. And so I think it's a little unfortunate still. There are still some adjudicators who have a bit of an attitude to adults. And I feel that, honestly, some of our colleagues are maybe a little bit threatened by the fact that here are these people who in some cases didn't grow up doing Irish dancing, and now suddenly they're coming into it, they're all excited about it. And some of these people who have, you know, long established Irish dancing are thinking, oh, maybe they're going to start a school and and like take over. And so
I don't understand that perspective. Like I always wondered what that kind of no adults attitude, like where that came from. And I think you probably just touched on it there, but I still don't understand it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, some people, I've heard people say over the years, oh, Irish dancing is like, it's for children. It's not for the adults. And it's like, you know, they clearly are not thinking like at all. They haven't opened their minds to the idea that somebody as a grown adult could decide, I want to start a new activity that I've never done before. And I want to put my heart and soul into it. Or somebody could say, here's this activity I did as a young child that I never really paid much attention to it. I just like went to it, but never took it seriously. And now I want to go back to it and I want to succeed in it. And so I feel that like, you know, that some people are just not thinking that that could be a thing. And clearly it is a thing. And
it's a big thing.
Yeah. And in our group in New York City, particularly now, we've for many years, we've had a large adult group of dancers, and the COVID really threatened that. A lot of our adult dancers, when we said to them, we're going to have to close our classes for a while, they said, we'll see you in a few weeks when this is over. And a few weeks clearly became a few years, and some of them never came back. And people moved on with their lives and did other things. And so it's very sad that we lost a lot of people. And like, one of the great things that's happened in the last year and a bit is that we've a load of new adults have joined our school, and some people who just moved to town, some people who decided to just take up Irish dancing again, or people who we didn't know who suddenly decided to join our school. And so we currently have a great group of adult dancers, and we just, our adult mixed Ceilidh team just won the North American Championships in July, and we have won the Mid-Atlantic region Oireachtas as recently as last month.
Yep.
And we've won it every year, the mixed Éireann Ceilidh, since 2014.
Yeah, so that is a huge accomplishment. Run. Congratulations. Yeah,
thanks so much. It's a great run of success, you'd say. But behind all that, we've a great squad of adult dancers. And I've explained it to many people about, like, it's like, let's say, I don't know, like a football team or a soccer team, where like you have a squad of people and there's eight people get picked for like a Ceilidh team. And then there's another squad of people. And so we actually had two ladies Éireann teams, which is 16 dancers in the Mid-Atlantic Rockets this year. And so everyone's in the photograph because it's a squad. It's not just about who gets picked on the winning team. And we've a great group. And then we also have a number of adults at an intermediate or beginner level who are in some cases in the same classes with these other people, or in a lot of cases, they socialize with them. And a lot of our adults come to our events. We do like music and dance jams a couple of times a week. And they show up and they all socialize together and dance at these events as well. And so we've a great group of people. And I would say, like, one of the great things over the years is that we've had people who are very nice, kind people, very resilient. And we've had people who are very understanding of other people. And we've many different kinds of people in our adult class. And obviously one of the things about teaching adults compared to children is that, you know, adults have other worries, they have other concerns, they have other things going on. And they're also very opinionated. And in some cases, they have very different opinions. But when we're in dancing class, we don't discuss politics. We don't discuss religion. We don't discuss the current topics of the day if they're in any way polarizing, because we're not there to do that. And there's many topics, obviously, where some people are very leaning one way or the other. And then there's other topics where people have just differences of opinion. And you can see a validity in all opinions. But in the dancing class, it's about the dancing.
And right, because for adults, you know, you're right, they have families, they have jobs, they have kids. Dancing is like their escape.
Yeah. But our dancing school is very welcoming of all different kinds of people. And I have to say, everyone is very respectful. We have loads of people who you'd say they'd never probably hang out socially if they were choosing to. But in dancing class, they're all happy to be dancing with each other because they're all really great people and they're coming from different directions. But and everyone has their own idiosyncrasies, but we work with that and we turn people from being, you know, a little bit, you'd say, some cases a little bit needy or unusual, and we turn them into team players and everyone has a great time. And, you know, we do social dancing and we do like solo dancing and we do competitive dancing. So we have a wide ranging adult program and, you know, we galvanize people, particularly for the regional Oireachtas every year. We have a lot of adults who do the Gaelic competitions. We have some adults who, we three adults who placed in the adult solo championship in the Mid-Atlantic region this year, which is great. And then we did another adult who won the Transed competition. And so we have a number of people who we challenge them at different levels, and we teach them interesting choreography, and we keep them engaged, and teach them technique as well. When I started teaching adults, I would say I was just teaching them choreography. And then I quickly realized these people need help with technique. We can't just be depending on people showing up for our adult class who already know how to do Irish dancing well. So there was a spectacular case a number of years ago of a woman who came into class with her feet completely pigeon-toed, and she said, "I'm here to learn Irish dancing." And I looked at her feet and I felt like saying to her, "With those feet?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "This is a challenge." And so I trained her how to turn out her feet. And I suppose the bottom line is she wanted to do it. And 4 years later, she dropped down to the over category, and she placed third in preliminary championship with her feet turned out.
And amazing.
So, like, you know, the success stories like that, that's, you say, going from one extreme to the other. But there's been a lot of people over the years who have poor, like, form. Their bodies are moving while they're dancing, or they just don't have good technique. And we basically work a lot with them. And so when someone decides to do something as an adult, yeah, like, there are some people. There was one woman who said to me, "I know I'm no good at dancing. I just like coming to class because I like the music." But most people want to challenge themselves in some way. And in some cases, it's about winning competitions. But in a lot of cases, it's about just seeing how good you can be as a dancer. And so you'd say teaching good technique is part of that. And I think, you know, we're fortunate that not just myself, but we have a team of teachers who are also passionate about transmitting their skills to the students. And, you know, there's some teachers who only want to teach children, but we have a range of teachers who all love teaching adults as well. And it's clearly a different challenge teaching adults. To try and keep everyone happy in the one room is not easy, but it's a challenge that I have been up for doing for many years. And there's been times when I've been maybe exasperated, but we keep going. And we've had some cases of people who've had a blowout in class. A woman got upset with me in October and was storming out of the room. And I went over and I said, "How long have we known each other? We need you here this evening." And then she came back. And it's like, you know, like, that we have our moments. And, you know, when everyone's passionate about something, there are going to be blowouts. And you just have to be able to deal with them in the best way possible.
Yeah, my biggest difference I find teaching adults is that, you know, kids, you show them something and they do it, right? Like, they'll give it a go, they'll try it. It might be completely wrong, but they don't really have a fear of doing anything. Whereas adults have a fear of possibly physically doing it, but also the fear of not doing it right, or the fear of judgment of other people. And I just find that difference really interesting.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's it exactly. I know we had an adult one time who had said to me, "I'm interested in doing my TCRG. Can I watch you teach a class?" And I was like, "I guess so." A number of people came up to me, "Why is she here? Like, I feel she's judging us." And so I was like, you know, like, yeah, people don't like to be watched when they're learning something. And we have a number of adults who love performing. And there's some then who don't really sign up for the performances, but we get them to do a performance when we have a lot of people. They're okay with doing that. And so some people are a little shy like that. They don't want to be in the public realm. It's not about, like, you know, showing off. And so, luckily enough, we've enough dancers that we don't need to pressurize people into doing things they don't want to do. And so we do performances all year round, and we're lucky we get to do a lot of performances for multicultural communities here in New York City as well. But yeah, like, you know, the whole, like, thing, the poster or the fridge magnet where it says, "Dance like nobody's watching." Like, I don't know. I mean, for me personally, like, I feel I dance better if people are watching.
But a lot of people, feel that way.
Yeah. There's other people who don't want to be watched. And so, yeah. So, like, you know, like, nobody wants to be judged in class. And so the dance studio should be a space where you can just do whatever you can do and nobody's judging you. And so, yeah, there are some people over the years, obviously, who take exception to corrections. And so one has to give corrections in the right way and to make them encouraging and to make people feel good about themselves, clearly. And yeah, that, like, adults maybe sometimes are more reactionary in that sense than children. And, you know, I've had children and adults who've reacted to corrections over the years. And some people, you know, just take it the wrong way. And you have to say to them, "Look, I'm giving you advice on how to do it better.
It's not personal."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that like one of the biggest things as a teacher is dealing with people and dealing with people when they're not at their best, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to really, I suppose, look at the big picture and say like, this person got upset today, but maybe they'll be okay the next time, you know? And you try and be encouraging to everyone is the thing. And how we've managed to keep our adult class together over the years, I would say that like, definitely we've had people who've fallen out with each other, but we just basically, we encourage everyone to treat people with respect and to be nice to each other and to work together with the common goal of trying to get better as dancers. And that's what it is. And whether people want to compete or whether people want to perform or whether they want to do either of that, they're all welcome. And everyone knows that in our school, we have space. We're lucky enough that we have time and space for all kinds of people who, whatever their goals are, we'll help them to be better dancers. And I have to say now, I thought it was very interesting there during the pandemic, one of our professional colleagues went off on a rant on Facebook about the whole thing about a lot of people post when they've a dancer win, like whether it's a hashtag or they just say it straight out, hard work pays off. And there was, I don't know if you, if anyone saw that, where this teacher went on a rant. She's like, hard work doesn't pay off because there's only one winner in every competition and everyone worked hard. And the reality is like, then you'd have to say like, well, what is the payoff? And the payoff is not winning first. The payoff is dancing your best. And so
yeah, the payoff is like the personal development and the process and the getting better, even if you didn't win.
Yes. And if you can walk off the stage thinking, wow, that's the best I've ever danced. I feel proud of myself. I feel happy in that I set out to achieve a goal and I just danced the best I've ever done. That is success. And whoever wins first, yeah, there's only one winner, or there might be a tie for first, but it's not about the winner. It's about dancing your best. And I must say, growing up in Ireland, we were used to the situation of every 4 years, the Olympics, and obviously in the United States, it's like, how many hundreds of medals will we win this year? But in Ireland, it was like, will we win a medal this year?
Right.
And there was many years where Ireland won no medals in the Olympics. And there was times where, with the time difference, you'd wake up in the morning and there'd be a report on the news that some athlete was in the semi-final of the 1500 meters and they came last in the semi-final, but they ran a personal best. And at the time I was thinking, why is this even news? This person went all the way around the world and they came last in their race. And of course, then I realized years later, actually, no, this person went halfway around the world and they ran the best they'd ever done in a different country, different
at the Olympics,
different time zone
in yeah
the Olympics, exactly. And there's actually a song that Mike Hanrahan, I believe, of Stockton's Wing wrote a song that was Ireland's Olympic theme and back in the year 1980 for the Moscow Olympics, and the song is called Run for the Gold. And they repeat the same lyric, run for the gold, run for the gold, over and over. And there's a really cool jig in the middle of it as well. Stockton's Wing are clearly the band in it, but it was kind of, I don't know, was it officially credited to Stockton's Wing, but anyway, or was it maybe Shay Healy wrote the song? Anyway, so I think it was Shay Healy wrote the song and Mike Hanrahan sang the song, yeah, from Stockton's Wing. But the end of the song is, it was about this guy who was training, running lone, the lone runner on the hillside, training in the early hours of the morning. And then the end of the song was not that he won. The end of the song was, he has run for his country. He has run for the gold. So the achievement was that you got to do it and that you did your best. And I mean, if you do the best ever, that's obviously the icing on the cake, but that's what achievement is. And I think that particularly like in terms of adults classes, like everyone has goals. Some people don't want to state their goals, but some people will talk openly about what their goals are. But the reality is like you're training everyone to get better. And really, it's about just how good of a dancer can you be? And with the right training, obviously, people can make improvements. And I had a great conversation with a musician recently, and they were talking about some fiddle player. Somebody said, oh, what do you think of so-and-so's fiddle playing? And they were like, ah, they're okay, but I think they'll get better. And then somebody said, why do you think they'll get better? And the thing is, like, if somebody keeps working at their craft, they mightn't perfect it, but they will continue to get better.
Yes.
And so, you know, that whether it's, you'd say a child maybe has greater capacity for learning, but an adult who dedicates themselves to something has also a great capacity for learning. And it's about, like, just like we said about adjudicating, you have to try and limit the distractions. And if you're focused on doing something, then if you focus on it, you're going to make some progress. And so, like, whenever you get up on the stage in the adult competition, you know there's loads of screaming children in the audience. There's husbands and boyfriends and girlfriends and partners, and everyone's there. And there's loads of distractions. But when they get up to dance, it's about how well can you demonstrate all the training you've put into it. And so I think, like, that, you know, as a teacher with a big adult program, we're trying to encourage everyone to achieve their goals. And where those goals align, obviously, is where we get everyone working together in class on the same material. And some people can do it better than others, but we always have, like, a more difficult or an easier option so that everyone can actually get through it. And it's great, you'd say, feeling to be able to train people who are working hard at something. And then I'd say sometimes the adults, sometimes, like, you know, they're in some cases more appreciative because they're more aware of the fact, the process that goes into it.
Absolutely.
And it's just, it's a very, very rewarding experience, I would say, teaching adults. And I've some of our colleagues have posted on Facebook in the last couple of years, oh, I just started adult class. I really love this.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're a little bit
missing out.
You're very welcome. Yeah. So great.
So I think the last little segment we'll do for, you know, today's discussion is one area we've seen a lot of progress in Irish dancing is how adults are included in competitions. It's starting to get better, right? I remember the days where, you know, adults capped out at prize winner, they only did fast speeds. Like, we're starting to recognize and acknowledge that adults can do more and want to do more, and they're willing to pay to do more. They've become a huge segment of, you know, the nationals. And, like, I got to sit down and watch my first adult championship at the North Americans this year, and it was the highlight of my week. I loved it. Watching the men and the women together, watching all the different representations of self in the costuming, and it's something you don't see in the kids competitions as much. I absolutely loved it. Where do you see adult Irish dancing in the future landscape of competitive dancing, or where would you like to see it?
Well, I think that there's clearly a lot of participation in it at the moment, but I think there's clearly a lot of space for more participation, and there's so many former dancers who I feel we can entice to come back to either the adult competitions or the adult masters competitions, as it's now apparently called. And so there's huge opportunity for growth. And one thing I think that needs to be addressed is that for many years, I feel there was a lot of Irish dancing schools who did offer an adult program, but it was just taught by another adult. It wasn't taught by, let's say, the same teachers who were training the champion younger dancers. And I feel that is changing now as well. I feel that there are some schools that are now dedicating more teaching resources to adults. And so the standard is going up. And I have to say, in the Mid-Atlantic region, the standard in adult ceilidh dancing is really high at the moment. And also, like, the adult championship in all the regions is a relatively still new idea, but the standard has really, like, you'd say, gone up in that as well. And so it's very exciting to see the progress being made. And yes, adults are being treated more seriously, and it's about time. And so I think that, like, you know, I think it'll continue to grow to such an extent that there will eventually be a World Championships adult category event.
I'd like to see that too.
And I think that is inevitable. And I think it's rather past remarkable, the fact that in the Jig movie back in, what year was that?
2011.
2011, that there were a group of essentially adult dancers from Russia who competed in the Worlds. And apparently they had to get some letter or something from the commission to be able to travel to Ireland or something. And of course, my adults were like, why are they in the Worlds and we're not? And basically there was no, I guess, adult category in Russia and Moscow at the time. So they ended up competing in the over 15s. And if my adults were to do the same thing, they would lose their adult status and couldn't compete for 5 years. And so I think that there's been great efforts at standardizing the rules for adult competitions in North America, but standardizing them, you'd say, all over the world is the next challenge. And I also feel that, like, some other Irish dancing organizations were a little bit ahead, certainly in Europe, in terms of promoting adult dancing and in terms of creating, like, bigger age brackets and, you know, having, like, adults compete against each other in, like, you know, maybe batches of, like, 30s, 40s, 50s kind of thing. And so I don't know, is that necessary really? But the thing is that, there needs to be, you'd say, somebody looking at the overall picture in terms of worldwide Irish dancing. And I certainly would like to, I might as well mention it here, I would like to see a situation where we have one world championships and that everyone can compete for the same event. I think it's ridiculous that there are a lot of different organizations all calling their event the world championships. And I think that's something that I would love to see looked at as well. I think that's the next step as well.
That would be pretty cool. That's a lot of people to agree on that, to make that happen, but I hope it does.
Yeah, but I think that it's very exciting that there are a lot of people who are clearly giving headspace to the adult competitions, which wasn't the case before. And once that happens, obviously, things can only get better because there's a lot of adult dancers who've now become teachers as well and are contributing to our dancing, you'd say, events in ways that if they hadn't been encouraged as adults, they wouldn't even be involved, you know? And so, it's amazing to think that, where some of these older teachers, I feel, had a bit of an attitude, some of them are now working alongside people who started dancing as adults, and they're the people that they had an attitude towards are now their esteemed professional colleagues. And so this is a good thing. And so it's great to think that I think people are just, more welcoming to adults. And so I think the category is definitely going to grow. And, the dancing is, the standard is getting higher. And it's very exciting times, I would say, for adult dancers.
I think so too. Well, Niall, so much good stuff in this discussion. And thank you again for coming on. Where can we keep up with you and all of your adventures?
So I generally post updates on my website at niallo'leary.com. And there's a kind of a grid of different boxes when you go to my homepage. And at the bottom, there's a box of events of what's happening, events we're performing at. And so we've a number of performances coming up. There's a big New York City Irish Dance Festival happening on Sunday, May the 5th, 2024. And you'll definitely be hearing about that in the social media channels and elsewhere between now and then. And we've other lesser events, you'd say, coming up as well. But it's just, we basically, we're keeping it going here in New York City and further afield, doing the music and the dancing. And I also have an architecture project, which I'm looking to make a lot of progress on the next year, House for an Irish Dancer.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I got to have you back on and we can talk Irish dance and architecture crossover because I would love to hear, I want to get in your brain on that one.
That'll be the next podcast.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again so much for coming.
Very good. Thanks so much. See you soon. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on TCRG to CEO Radio.